Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Symmetry of Soul, in-depth synthesizing study of the Urantia book for able and willing students. Tonight, paper 52, and perhaps a touch of paper 50. It's a new arc on purpose and destiny. Quote, mortal affairs are almost but not quite utopian. This truly is a great and glorious age, is what the revelators say about the future. Not necessarily the present. But what an adventure. What a romance. I'm Brad Garner. So glad that you're here with us live or in our archive at symmetryofsoul.org. With me tonight is Dr. Chris Halverson and Kermit Anderson. Andrea Barnes should be along in just a little bit. But we also have you here. Call up the text of the Urantia book by paper or electronic means and take a virtual seat with us. Good evening, Dr. Chris.
Good evening, Brad. And hello, Kermit, and everyone listening. And we'll welcome in Andrea here shortly, hopefully. As Brad is saying, now for something quite different from where we were just last week. We're going to kind of pull back a bit and look at some of the big picture aspects of the universe that we live in. The universe of universes that we live in. In particular, as the arc title says, to take a look at the papers here that we've selected in this arc under the banner of purpose and destiny. There's always been lots of controversy, you know, ever since the early times of philosophic considerations. Whether there was purpose and destiny, you know, and if so, what was it, and how do you resolve all the confusions with a belief that there is purpose and destiny, you know, with all the vicissitudes of time that are constantly besetting us. So, this should be an interesting arc to explore some of those issues, and as usual, the revelators will confront us with some rugged issues.
That's right. That's very, very correct. They will be rugged issues, but they will be enveloped within the framework of the fifth epical revelation, a cosmic framework. So I, as always, appreciate your attempts at precision of language, Chris. As tempting as it is to quote Monty Python, and you want to say something completely different, this is not completely different. Because we strive for a synthetic understanding of the Urantia book here. And, I just noticed there was an obituary recently for a noted physicist of the 20th century. He also was at my alma mater. And unlike one of his rugged truths, ours will be couched in theistic contexts. This professor was famous for writing, "The more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it also seems pointless," said Steven Weinberg. Let's not go there with a rugged truth, because that's not...
Yeah, true. See, as I said, this whole issue of purpose and destiny has gotten some consideration over the centuries.
That's right. People talk about it, even when they think they don't want to talk about it because they're just into physics. They'll end up talking about it. Unavoidable. All right. And Kermit, good evening to you. I think before we sally forth into our next adventure here, we should wrap up a little bit of business from the previous arc, a marvelous one. How would you say that we did, wrapping things up?
Well, before we do that, why don't we welcome in, I noticed Andrea has just signed in, so why don't we get her her greeting, and then I can certainly do that.
Aha!
I'm here!
Hello, Andrea.
I'm still in transit, but I can hear everybody, and I'll look forward to this evening's show. Thanks for having me in here.
Excellent.
All right.
Glad to have you here at the start of a new arc, Andrea. And now back to the business at hand. Kermit, take us back a week. Where were we?
Okay, a little flashback here. Symmetry of Soul explored some further thoughts on the idea of the grace of being a person, a part, lovingly encompassed in the cosmic whole, endowed with faculties of faith, reason, and volition. sharing various aspects of the cosmic concept frames in the fifth epical revelation with our fellows is all too often met with formidable obstacles, not the least of which is a failure to acknowledge common foundational facts. Limited advancement in certain realms of human activity is possible in simpler times pursuing shared belief systems, yet increasing complexity of human activities demands greater acceptance and accuracy of the factual foundations for meaningful conclusions and valuable considerations. The fifth epical revelation presents us with numerous facts unattainable save by revelatory disclosure. An example of this is the field of psychology, where today large segments of those who call themselves psychologists deny the existence of mind distinct from matter, while students of the revelation can validate the truths of many aspects of mind and spirit through actual experience. But it is we who must summon our curiosity and cultivate our God-given hunger and thirst for the real to avail ourselves of these disclosures. The born-again and the born-again-again experiences were further distinguished in terms of the born-again experience reflecting a more indirect penetration of spirit ministry recognition from above to the domain of agitant mind, whereas the born-again-again phenomena refers to more direct engagement with mind-spirit ministry in the supermind domain of human and divine interrelationship. We picked up our reading in the middle of section 7 as Jesus passed by. Departing from the sequential narrative, the section contains illuminating aspects of Jesus' style of intimate ministry as he spontaneously responded to diverse individuals and varieties of circumstance, imbuing those he encountered with confidence, comfort, and increased capacity for solving their manifold problems. His techniques of serving those fortunate enough to be on the receiving end of his love and mercy stand as a master class in loving service to our fellows, which we all are invited to strive to emulate. Section 8, the final section of our arc. This parable, the parable of the pounds, this parable, while similar to the parable of the talents, was intended for the apostles and not the multitudes. The differences both in the two parables as well as the differences between the gospel version of the parable of the pounds and the midweek version are noteworthy and were discussed. Additionally, the issue of weights, measures, and currency in the two accounts were addressed. Listen to the archive to sort out the details. For comparison, we read paper 175, section 3, paragraph 4, the parable of the talents, which the midwayers refer to but do not present until Jesus had entered Jerusalem the following week. Clarification of the differences in the meaning of the two parables is attributed to Nathanael in the after years and summarized by the midwayers, concluding with 4 points of reflection. I must confess a continued need for reflection, as I am still unclear on the full meaning of Nathanael's teaching. Our arc concludes with the Master, with cheerful dignity and a gracious majesty, addressing his 12 apostles, saying, "Come, my brethren, let us go into Jerusalem, there to receive that which awaits us. Thus shall we fulfill the will of the Heavenly Father in all things." And here ends the summary.
Thank you, Kermit. Thank you, as always, and thank you for the contrite confession about not fully having gotten to the bottom of the difference between those two parables. I looked back at my notes, and I did write sort of my summary quick takeaway of them, but I'll admit, when you read through those 4 points, I almost felt like I probably should have done some homework and diagrammed them out, you know, ability and capacity, and trying to make sense of it and to get at what Nathanael thought Jesus was getting at. But yeah, we might talk about it some more, but I'll open it up for any clarifications, any other things on folks' mind right now.
Well, I don't know. I was kind of disappointed that Kermit didn't get into a detailed review about the conversion between Attic Minas and Avoirdupois pounds. yeah, that's unfortunate. But
we'll look for that on Perfecting Horizons, Chris, the white paper shortly.
But you know, one thought that I thought I'd toss out since you brought up, you know, wanting to reflect further on those four bullet points that Nathaniel enumerated, or that the Midwayers enumerated for Nathaniel. You know, when you think about items 3 and 4, this whole issue of what exactly is the reality that's being analogized when it talks about the master grants the lesser reward for lesser faithfulness when there is like opportunity, and he grants a like reward for like faithfulness when there is lesser opportunity. Notice, it doesn't say lesser faith, or like faith. It uses that word faithfulness. You want to reflect on, I think Brad was maybe just mentioning that, the issue of capacity. Remind yourself always that you're attempting to understand your relationship to the cosmos, not in a point-to-point fashion. You're one point, the cosmos is the other point, and there's some sort of interaction along some line.
Yeah.
But you have this capacity that's been granted to you by grace. The fullness therein, and its ever higher quality, its ever higher levels of quality, is very much in your free will hands. Think about the classic we bring up oh so often. You know that upper domain is being grown. But that growth is dependent upon quote unquote favorable conditions which you supply. If you supply fuller conditions, fuller growth results.
Right.
It doesn't matter how much you imagine, you have this vast domain that can be filled up by, through growth, a domain that was supplied by grace alone and all this. Every nook and cranny of that domain is subject to your sovereignty.
Yeah.
And nothing happens there unless you will it. Not to mention things happen there if you unconsciously will it. Just to remind everyone of the difference between talking about will and talking about self-assertion. One consciously asserts oneself, but will is transcendent of that and hence subject to complications, like unconscious exercise of will. There's a reason why, they said faithful. Yes, you've got always have that faith nucleus. When you start using analogies like wholehearted, right, or in contrast to half-hearted, right, what are they getting at there? That might be applicable to lesser reward for lesser faithfulness.
Well, how is it that these apply to those two parables? That's what I am having a difficult time.
Three goes with one of the two parables, and four goes with the other of the two. I'll give you
well,
that hint.
I figured.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Parable of the pounds. I see that all over number three. Everyone's given 10 pounds equally because there's,
you know, like people, opportunity.
Like opportunity. Yeah.
Right.
But there's a different outcome. Each of the given the exact same number of pounds, different people ended up doing different things at the end. And you know, in the parable, that's symbolic of, well, what's faithfulness here.
Yeah. You know, and you know, because a pint can't hold a quart, okay, by definition, the pint has lesser opportunity. However, you know, it doubled its wholeheartedness, just like the quart did.
In the parable of the talents,
in the parable of the talents.
Okay. All right. Okay.
Yeah. Once you work through it, it makes sense, and it's also edifying to hear that that's the kind of cosmos that we live in. It seems, I think most people from age six onward should be able to look at that and say, well, it seems fair. It seems fair. It all seems fair.
Yeah, and I mean, even though Jesus of Nazareth couldn't be the vehicle for taking the actual spiritual uplifter aspect of a bestowal son very far, subsequently as a master son, Michael of Nebadon did, see to it that everyone got his spirit of truth as a spirit of unification to allow a unification with an adjuster for everyone, no matter how symbol-like your capacity. Forget about pints and quarts. Maybe we're talking teaspoons. Right? But nonetheless, right, you get an adjuster by grace that can take, you know, that teaspoon and bring it to an effective focus. Right? It's a catalytic agent for the focalizing influence of Mother Deity.
Right.
It's a lens, you know, if you will. I'll use that analogy. Right. So, you know, even more so is there like reward for like faithfulness.
Okay.
And it's, you know, there's, you've basically, taken... these sort of transhuman issues out of play. I mean, everyone's got their encirclement of the Holy Spirit. Everyone's got the Word of Truth. Everyone's got a thought adjuster. So it's, then it's just an issue of how that engagement will play out relative to the facts of time. Are you starting with a teaspoon or are you starting with a gallon?
Eyedropper.
Gosh.
Yeah, God's pipette.
I'm almost feeling, but you know what? I'm off the clock from my day job, so I shouldn't. Maybe I should do this. I'm almost sensing this could use a quadrant diagram. You know, with let's see, faithfulness on the x-axis, opportunity on the y-axis, and the things written in the quadrants being rewards. I think this would plot just fine. I don't think that would help you, Kermit, unless that's your style. But I'm just saying, it is plottable.
I was wondering if you were going to go with titration there or something, you know, where I was taking us. But
I wouldn't rule that out. Yeah.
Okay. But yeah, anyway, that yeah, everyone, you know, just reflect on you know, as I was just saying, that you have sort of the full unity of spirit now, without any qualifications. We don't need to put asterisks on things. You know, so then it very much boils down to the physical and, you know, and mental differentials that are predicated on the genetics. You know, and mm-hmm. and that interestingly, you know, will play right into where we're going next in the next arc of you have all of these issues, evolutionary issues, inescapably tied to the facts of time, whatever they may be, and you know, there's no magic finger that can change those material foundations that are being ministered to. You're ministered to as those ministries find you. I mean, part of the grace is that they can find you, no matter what you are. Right?
Yeah.
They can meet you where you are, as you are, no matter what that might be. But
what a relief! Yeah.
What that is all over the map. Especially if you think beyond just our world, you know, to all of the different types of worlds, different types of mortals.
Well, it could have been a timely arc any time we brought it up, but it certainly seems timely because I guess I'm still thinking about this physicist who, you know, these broadside attacks on religious belief that are very popular these days. They have been for over 100 years. And one of the observations is they look across the whole world and they say, well, which God is it? There's like 3,000 of them. These people over here, in the African outback, think that it's this God, and these people over here think it's that God. And well, it can't possibly be all of them. It can't. So they go take it one step further. They're like, therefore, it's none of them. But they're missing a transcendent way forward, which is there's a grace at play where no matter what your concept of God, bottom up, top down, something in between, a mixture, you can be met where you're at in any mortal age or in any age in your own life.
Yeah, not to mention just the missing yet another of the infinite number of opportunities to challenge their assumption of philosophic materialism.
Like, right,
well, if all these creatures are is collections of molecules, why do, hydrocarbons dream of a quote-unquote God?
Yeah, where does that come from? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's obviously, like I said, I mean, that's just one of millions and millions of like points, should give you some suggestion that maybe we're not just a material assemblage, but but why not start with something kind of very glaring, and stop just dismissing it, like you're saying that they're doing, Brad. I mean, it's such a a cop out. If they think that they're such a brilliant mind, why don't they demonstrate it to us?
Right. Why throw in the towel and just say, well, it's all pointless? And not in a deep way like King Solomon did in Ecclesiastes. He was onto something else entirely than what Steven Weinberg was onto. But, it's much more challenging to contemplate a cosmos where purpose and destiny must be so conditioned, so experiential in nature and so varied, and yet all pointing to some single unity, some universal unity, if only that was the name of some sort of paper.
that might have something to do with the word destiny in our arc title. Yes. yeah. Right. I mean, we can. It's these individuals that get up to the third level of philosophy, you know, and then become poster children for the pathetic and pitiful declarations about those individuals.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's too easy, you know, to mock them. I mean, it's just, it's so absurd what passes for, you know, brilliance. I mean, it's such juvenile thinking. You know, there's all sorts of silly notions of God, therefore God doesn't exist. What kind of quality of thinking is that? Yeah. As I you know, often pointed out, you know, in talking about that thought amongst those people, it's like, okay, so wait a minute. John, you're telling me that because kindergartners don't know that calculus exists, it doesn't exist. You know?
It's pretty strange. Yeah, the bar, the high existential bar they set for the moment we come out of our mother's womb is impossible to achieve. And you say it's pathetic because it's so lacking in any kind of philosophy, any recognition of the experiential on a individual level or a larger level.
Yeah. Or because that kindergartner, whose parents, actually teaches calculus, and so they've heard the word calculus and they blurt it out, because that kindergartner can't give a rational description of what calculus is, therefore calculus doesn't exist.
And as we've seen with Brad's famous and oft quoted statement about atheists having their point, so much of the atheistic arguments really bespeak an individual who's not well. I'm getting feedback. Anybody hearing that?
Yeah, I'm hearing the feedback too. Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, the atheists just don't know themselves, and they have never plumbed their reactionary attitude towards the religions of evolution, such that they think they're attacking God, or they think they're attacking a God that doesn't exist. So it's a sad state of affairs.
Yeah, like I said, as the Revelators point out, all they're really doing when they talk like that, is putting a sandwich sign on, and one side of the sandwich sign says pitiful, and the other says pathetic. I mean, it's just amazing, that they just, like you said, that they just do not know themselves.
Right. I mean,
I
think when we invoke the aphorism, the atheists have a point here, I think we're talking about the baby in the bathwater problem. You know, the baby they identify is superstitious notions of God, but the bathwater is everything else they throw out, and that's what turns them into this kind of foolish intellectual giant. They didn't distinguish the two.
Right.
And it's just, sort of the bottom line, of the Revelators laying out those four levels of philosophy is, okay, you can talk about, the relative differential, between level one and level two and level three. But when all is said and done, there's only one real level, and one, two, and three, are just scaffolding, When all is said and done, they amount to nothing.
Yeah.
Either you get to reality, or eventually you cease to exist.
And that's really a philosophic question, isn't it, Chris? Getting to reality.
Yeah. Yes. Right. I mean, the fourth level of philosophy is the level of philosophy. Right.
Yeah.
Everything else is just a pretender. You have to get all the way. I mean, you know, when all is said and done, either you fuse with your adjuster or, you know, everything else is irrelevant.
Well, for you, it's irrelevant. Your experiences persist in the universe in other ways.
Right.
But, yeah, for you, that's
yeah.
it.
Right. Exactly. I mean, that's what I meant by that.
Yeah,
right. I mean, you as an individual, either you really separate your drop of water from the ocean, or right, it doesn't matter, you know, how many times your drop of water leapt up but fell back down again, or how high it leapt before it fell back down again. In the end, what difference does it make?
Yeah.
So, you know, that... you know, as we often talk about, eventually, you know, there's a binary issue that you have to face.
You know, there's only the way.
There aren't gradations of finaliters, you know. Like, you know, either you're a finaliter or not.
You know, I wonder about those people that have such issues with the idea of subordination. You know, there's groups of people that are just thinking, there's no way I'm going to subordinate myself to anything. I'm hoping that once they wake up on the mansion, well, they'll have a change of heart about these sorts of things. But I know a few that they're a worry a bit.
Right. And again, we all know it's not impossible to harden one's heart here, you know, which the adjuster will, you know, dutifully copy into your soul, so you wake up with a soul that has just as hardened a heart as the one you left behind here.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it's again, it's once you know this, it's like, well, how about if I, you know, get about the Father's business now, right? How about if I assume I already have serious reality issues? Maybe I should courageously challenge myself here. You know, and you do need to subordinate yourself.
I think what they confuse is they think of subordinating themselves to a organized religion in a way. You know, they don't know anything higher. And so because their imagination is so bleak, you know, cooperative subordination to something that they don't have any respect for, of course that's not going to work.
Yeah, but of course, as we've talked about recently with our playing around with our born again, you know, differential. I mean, you know, why is it that people fear to be born again? Because to be genuinely born again and to maintain that is to assume and maintain unquestioning loyalty to the doctrines of an evolutionary religion. Period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? And it's like, well, I'm not going to do that. It's like, well, then there's no way for you ever be born again.
Yeah.
Where you actually can, you know, enter into, you know, free service and liberty-loving devotion.
But, you know, Kermit brought this up a couple weeks ago. He and I both skipped, well, I mean, not me entirely, but the whole being involved intimately with a church, an evolutionary religion. We just went straight for, you know, we went right to the Urantia book at an early age.
Right, but again, you know, and you know, we don't need to rework all of that. I mean, you know, it's one of the reasons why the fifth ethical revelation is here to help foster, you know, a way to to get to the upper domain, you know, without kind of sort of backing into it, as it were, through the evolutionary religious born again. I mean, it's not that it's technically impossible, but I mean, see, the problem is it's such a challenge, and the very attitude, you know, that made you say, well, I'm not going to submit to a evolutionary religion and its dogmas. I mean, see, that very attitude makes it impossible for you to take advantage of, you know, the exception to the rule, as it were. I mean, how are you ever going to be humble enough, right, to submit yourself to the authoritative elimination of error? You know, and have it help you to respond enough to the philosophic impulse, apart from some secular identification of your religious impulse, so that you can actually follow it up into the upper domain. I mean, it's just, you know, there's a normal evolutionary process that, you know, we're about to read about, that beings come down from on high to facilitate, that, you know, gets everyone to born again, you know, kind of backs them into that, as it were. They have all, you know, in full flower of primitive, superstitious, you know, beliefs and whatnot, you know, but eventually fosters them to be born again from that starting point that they saw to it was in full flower, kind of like the Indispensables. I mean, sure, you know, we all love the idea of beings coming from on high and fostering true religion, true monogamy, prayer, and God consciousness for us. But then we're told, yeah, but before we can do that, we have to foster slavery, war, social classes, and profit motive. Because until you foster those and bring them to full flower and work through them and leverage off them, there's no possibility to get to true religion, true monogamy, prayer, and God consciousness.
You know, that one, as inconvenient as it can be for some people to consider, I think readers of the Urantia book have an easier time with that one than this one here of like, well, before you can be born again, before you can, you've got to first be born again. You've got to go through your superstitious phase and all these. I think there are people who imagine they have bypassed those or would like to think that it's possible to bypass those, because something about that feels unappealing, even in a way that war and slavery does not feel unappealing.
Yeah, see, and if somehow, you know, that wasn't, you know, it wasn't the case, then there wouldn't have been an emergency 4,000 years ago. The Melchizedeks wouldn't have, you know, decided they needed to step in. I mean, the whole point is, it doesn't matter if it's, you know, a creator son incarnate as Jesus of Nazareth, he can't uplift that which doesn't exist.
Yeah.
You know, there's, you know, unless you have the potential that's been activated in the lower domain, how can anyone uplift that potential into its actualization in the upper domain? You can't make something from nothing. Right? To believe that you can is the same reason why you probably believe the Big Bang Theory. You can't make something from nothing. That's illogical. Right?
No, but we,
so there
but,
has
you know,
to be
we,
some,
we,
one way or another, there has to be something in that lower domain. Like I was saying, either it's kind of the normal, straightforward, evolutionary religion born again, and it doesn't matter how much people are backing into it, and, you know, and clueless they are. Right? They've potentialized, and that's worked with. You know, if it's not that, it has to be the equivalent, but you're now going to not be backed into it. You're going to have to do it a little bit more facing forward, which means your issues are going to get in the way. You know,
well,
like,
thank goodness for the mansion rules.
Yeah. Yeah, right. I mean, it becomes more and more obvious when you know the physics of all this, you know, why there are mansion worlds. know, because especially for this world, I mean, you know, we're just so messed up. But nonetheless,
well, I mean,
you know, the mansion worlds are still just, you're going to pick up, you know, your Mirage itself is going to pick up where it left off, you know. And so we want to start working here on facing facts and not thinking, well, there's going to be some magic on the mansion worlds that's going to fix me. It's like, not if you've willed otherwise. You know, so stop, you know, stop with the false liberty willing of yourself. You need to let go. And,
well, and isn't
allow
this where
growth?
Isn't this where the obdurate failure to or refusal to subordinate oneself to higher authority comes from? It's a residue of the whole rebellion idea. Mm-hmm. And once welcomed into, yeah, plus we have no visible universe administrators to authoritatively guide us. So when we get to the mansion worlds, there will be a whole cultural shift, and large numbers of beings will be living and demonstrating varying degrees of cooperative subordination. It'll be much easier for even the hardened hearts to begin to get a picture of where things might be possible to go.
Yeah, not to mention the realization of survival and what that does to a person.
Sure.
Yeah, and as I was about to say, you know, I mean, it's good news that when I wake up on the first mansion world, Lucifer's minions aren't going to be teaching my class.
Exactly.
Yeah, that'll be helpful. Yeah.
If I woke up there 200,000 years ago, right, expecting what Kermit was just describing, instead I got all of Lucifer's minions teaching me.
Yeah, it would have been rough.
Lord.
Now we're.
Yeah, how would you discern? How would you ever discern? Yeah.
Nice. I mean, you know, not even the angels could discern. I mean, it's like, well, look at him. He's so brilliant, you know, in spiritual luminosity.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you know, and I'm just a former blob of protoplasm waking up, and somehow I'm going to, you know, pick up, you know, something that they're missing.
Maybe
if I availed myself of my adjuster, but boy.
That begs the question, why did they let that happen? Everyone should have an opportunity, and those kids, people didn't get the opportunity.
Yeah, why do bad things happen to good people on the mansion worlds? See, yeah, you thought the historical problem of why do bad things happen to good people on nativity spheres. Well, why do bad things happen to good people in heaven?
Huh. Free will.
See, I mean, again, the fifth epical revelation doesn't supply a deliciously straightforward answer, right, to the question of why do bad things happen to good people. No, it makes the question all the more sobering. I mean, again, do you want free will or not? Right, then you have to figure it out. You know, and the only way to figure it out is to have to always have the presence of falsehood available to you.
But, you know, Chris, it does say somewhere in the book that, that you will be, you'll have full allowance for development, and the things that have held you back will be made up to you, you know, that they don't, you know what I mean?
Again, there's, you know, nothing will stop you except yourself. That's all we're trying to say. I mean, you know, we can quote the hundreds and hundreds of things about how much help you'll get, right? But they're only valid if the person is not stopping themselves.
Fair enough, yeah.
Right? See, I mean, I every time I've gotten into this conversation with someone, I just remind them, it's like, well, if you're humble, talk about those favorable conditions, if you're humble, then all of those good news sentences in the book apply to you. And you'll get, you know, more help than you can even imagine. 500,000 times more help than you'll need will be available to you.
So a lot of mercy credits there, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But.
Yep.
There's none so blind as those who will not see. All of the infinite, you know, beneficence in the universe doesn't change the fact that when all is said and done, you have absolute sovereignty over your real self. You know, and either you really figure it out, or you don't.
Not for those timid souls.
Right. Yeah. So it's just a matter of finding, you know, digging deep and finding the courage to just know that I need to do this, right? And there's no time like the present, right? To ask myself some serious questions about what am I unquestioningly loyal to? What is my religion? You know, is it a religion, you know, in a proper sense that somewhere buried way down deep in the midst of all my ignorance and foolishness, there's a red thread that takes me in and up to God? Or have I constructed this religion without any relationship to even the most primitive God or deity notion? Is it wholly secular what I am unquestioningly loyal to? Okay? Then, you know, you are the person that the Melchizedeks were looking at 2,000-4,000 years ago and saying, well, Michael's a pretty cool being, but he can't uplift nothing. This person is wholly secular. You know, and that means eventually the drop of water is just the ocean.
They're wholly secular. Their whole cannot grow to encompass the real whole. It has a ceiling at the material nativity sphere level. It has no transcendence in it.
I mean, again, the Melchizedeks were looking at fine, decent people. You know, they weren't looking at, you know, some caricature, you know, people running around with, you know, bloody axes.
Snarling, filthy hulks of men. No.
Yeah, exactly.
let's not cast the secularists into the realm of the unreal totally. I mean, their very ignorance is their salvation because of the superconscious grace that they've been encircuited right. And have thought adjusters.
Yeah, of course. Again, right? But, you know, it's just when, you know, we talk about the specific issue, you know, of is there something that you know, Jesus of Nazareth could work on uplifting here or not, right? You know, or is this person just completely secular? Sure, you know, all those people that the Melchizedeks were worried about woke up on the first mansion world. Again, we always come up against, it's like, you know, we're always trying to think about that everything is about us and, you know, and our salvation. It's like, no, you know, we all need to be able to just set that aside and recognize there's bigger issues in play than individual salvations. You know, it doesn't matter how much religion has never been concerned with that before. The fifth epical revelation is trying to get us to appreciate that. You know, the emergency that was, you know, was happening 4,000 years ago is in the sense of what we're about to start reading about in this next arc. Right? I mean, you know, when you're talking about a spiritual uplifter, you're talking about a spiritual uplifter of civilization. Right? More
right.
foundationally than individuals. Yeah, and even when you're talking about the biologic uplifters, which seems like, well, that's definitely talking about individuals, is it not, Chris? Yeah, but for the sake of civilization, not for the sake of the individuals, first and foremost. You know, it's like, well, why not? It's like, well, because when all is said and done, the individuals, you know, must take care of themselves. They're sovereign. But those who conduct the big picture of the external world, right, where I'm not sovereign,
right.
right, they're coming to work on those issues. Again, it's just that's what's so pointed about what happened 200,000 years ago in Gerizim. You didn't have a civilizational issue there, right? I mean, you don't have an evolution of civilization, you know, in any mortal world sense going on Gerizim. It's basically an individual thing. And they're all saying, Gabriel, step in and save the individuals. And he says, the individuals are sovereign. They need to do it themselves. Because we respect their sovereignty. Either they do it or they don't. Gabriel can't save me.
You have to be sophistry proof.
You have to be sophistry proof. I mean, he's thinking, it's like if you're so dense, you know, that you're falling for what Lucifer is selling, what do you think I'm going to do for you? Right. And that's all very relative to the world today. I mean, the things that are being sold and bought philosophically, it's like, seriously? You're falling for that. That sounds like a great idea to you.
Mm-hmm.
Really? Okay, so there's nothing I can do to help you. Because if that isn't trivially obvious to you, that that's garbage, then what do you expect me to do for you? It's either obvious or it's not. And the individual's relationship to destiny is in their absolute free will hands. But the destiny of worlds, that's in the hands of those who come down to facilitate that. Right? We think of these being all these beings coming down to they're coming down to help me.
No,
I'm not.
No, you're a transient phenomenon.
That's not what they're about. It's not what we're going to be reading about. And it's just this is the big obstacle to get to the fifth epical revelation. Everyone is still clamoring for their salvation. You know, and having their material prayers answered.
Yeah.
And clamoring for superhuman aid to come in and make it all better instead of taking care of themselves.
You know.
And parking spaces.
Oh,
it's like I thought
sure.
You said this was the material comfort era. Come down and make my material life comfortable, damn it.
This is my era. me. Yeah.
Yeah. So, anyway.
Shall we
get
into it? All right.
Yeah, we kind of curiously sort of morphed into a predicate for talking about what we're going to engage here in this next arc.
We did, as often happens. So in this new arc, everyone, we are going to be studying papers 52, 55, and 56. So it's an arc comprising three papers. So we won't be studying 53 or 54. Those are for different consideration. Longtime readers might have the titles of those memorized. They seem to be fan favorites, but we won't cover those here.
We just talked about them in passing, the Lucifer Rebellion. But
they're fan favorites. Not a week goes by. Yeah. But yeah, we are studying Purpose and Destiny. It's an intriguing arc title. And we're starting here in paper 52, Planetary Mortal Epics, page 589 of the original single column text. Anything we want to say before we start the very first reading? Any prefatory remarks?
I'll do the preparatory remarks after we get the initial little paragraph here out in play.
From the inception of life on an evolutionary planet to the time of its final flowering in the era of light and life, there appear upon the stage of world action at least seven epochs of human life. These successive ages are determined by the planetary missions of the divine suns. And on an average inhabited world, these epochs appear in the following order. 1. Pre-planetary prince, man. 2. Post-planetary prince, man. 3. Post-Adamic man. 4. Post-magisterial son, man. 5. Post-bestowal son, man. 6. Post-teacher son, man. 7. The era of light and life.
Okay. So, the first is, you know, just to pause for a moment and ponder the curious title of paper 52. Planetary Mortal Epics. Why is it titled thus? Especially since, you know, think about how frequently we sort of touch upon this, this sevenfold sequence, and we use the word dispensations. Okay, and you know, we did title this series, and the subtitle here is Planetary Dispensations. Just to that point. And we'll talk about that in a minute here. But the paper is entitled Planetary Mortal Epics. What's up with that? Let's start with, because this is a little technical detail that we'll get into even more when we do touch back into paper 50, section 5. But epics. Okay. Besides just thinking of words like epic and age and era, as words that you sort of, arbitrarily decide, well, I'm going to call this period of time an epic, and I'm going to call this period of time an age, and this period of time an era. The thing about the word epic, is it very, very definitively suggests that. The period of time that you're talking about is in some way a grand beginning. Right? And so if you say there's seven epochs, the first thing they're trying to tell you is it's not like the first one's the beginning and the last one's the ending. Every one of them's a beginning. Right? And that's an important truth. Related to the purposing of reality, right? That every moment is really a new beginning, because there aren't really endings.
Right.
If you want to take it all the way, there isn't really time. Right? So the fact that we have, a time viewpoint, we have an experiential nature that has a time viewpoint, but the source of all this is eternity. So eternity engages this temporal sequence, and it does so absolutely. It doesn't just engage the beginning point or the end point in some linear analogy of the sequence. It touches every point equally. So, that initiating touch from eternity makes every moment a beginning.
It's very literally the case, not just poetic flourish, yeah.
Not poetic, literally. Right? And so no matter how much your life may have gone astray, as I was indicating before, there's no time like the present to really begin. Because as much as you could have, you think, wow, oh, the real opportunity to begin was back then and I screwed it up. No. Eternity is just as present now as it was back when you quote-unquote screwed it up. Right? Start now. Eternity that you're looking for help knows no difference between now and back then. Start now. So every period here is an epic, a new beginning. No matter how much bias you might apply to them from a time viewpoint, you know, it's like, well, there's number one. I mean, you can't have post-planetary Prince Man until you have pre-planetary Prince Man, duh. But that's from the time viewpoint. From the eternity viewpoint, there is no pre and post.
That's right. Hard to wrap your mind around.
Okay. So they're epics. They're grand beginnings. And yet another grand beginning. And yeah, you have an endless sequence of new beginnings through endless cycles of eternity ahead of you. The other thing, though, that's very striking is, okay, and this kind of gets more to why they're called planetary mortal epics, the point here is that, yeah, and you see, notice, it's called pre-planetary prince man, post-planetary prince man, et cetera. You have seven different orders of humans. I mean, first there's a divine ministry engaging one type of human, and then another type of human, and then another type of human, right? Pre-planetary prince man is not post-planetary prince man. I mean, those are two different types of men, of humans. Huh. See, there's seven epics of human life. Again, to if you stop thinking of yourself as a blob of material molecules, but as a conscience, a conscious self, that is involved in a physical, mindal, spiritual triunity energy system, right? That domain in which you have a conscious self is of one order, and then that is changed. The whole, especially when you think in terms of the mindal and the spiritual, from one dispensation to the next, that all changes. And so you can't be a pre-planetary prince man after the planetary prince arrives. It doesn't matter how primitive you are. All men were changed because the mindal and spiritual system changed that you exist within.
This is a concept that, on the surface, on the face of it, it's easy enough to accept. You can't be a pre-planetary prince man after the planetary prince arrives. All right, that parses. A computer could figure that out. But this deeper thing, this idea that I could be reading, I mean, at this point, there's been enough time that things have been written. I could be reading something written by someone in a different planetary mortal epoch. And assuming all the translations haven't butchered it beyond belief, I'm reading something that came out of a mindal system that is not the same as mine. We are different types of humans. That's a little harder to fathom.
Yeah. See, there's type one planetary mortals, and there's an epic with them. Then there's type two planetary mortals, and there's an epic with them. And there's type three. See, that's the change in the order of planetary mortal, right, is what is the foundation for these epics.
And do you imagine that there's beings that come down to assist with those different epics, and they've been trained on what, on how to deal with and what to expect from that particular type of mankind that's living at that mm-hmm. time? Yeah, that's cool.
You know, when there was a dispensational resurrection relative to the fourth epical revelation, right? I mean, we've talked about that, you know, before, and we've gotten into the details. Right? Remember that, before the line was drawn, and and literally the energy system that is man was changed, right? Subsequent to that dispensational resurrection, right? And then you started a new dispensation. Right? I mean, everyone of that prior type of human, right, is involved, even though they're still alive at the moment of that dispensational resurrection. You know, they're going to be part of that dispensational resurrection, everyone that was alive before the energy system changed. You know, you're going to resurrect all of those types of humans, you know, because that's the kind of resurrection you're doing. Right? And subsequent ones are a different flavor. You know, it's shades of, you have to have separate resurrection halls for each of the different Sangic races.
Yeah. You know, I was just thinking today about the cutoff between these different resurrections and how families might, you know, rarely become, under different dispensational resurrections, and so they lose track of each other for quite some time. You know, like, oh, it's been a million years since I've been awake, and you're just waking up. Okay.
But eventually it's a total whatever.
Yeah, right.
You know, what's a million years, you know, in the span of billions? What's a billion years in the span of trillions?
Hmm.
Yeah.
Wow.
I want to just stress that there's seven epics of human life.
On a world, like seven different types
of any,
men.
In any world, yeah.
Right.
Would we be considered in the post-Adamic man epic, or would we be more, because we're out of order, where are we here?
Post the stole.
There's literally a section in this paper titled about us.
You guys.
Yeah.
Right? If you go to section six, it's entitled Urantia's Post Bestowal Age.
Okay, great.
Right? Okay, yeah, so we're that flavor of human. Right, like it or not, right, and that's, you know, so that, and that's, you know, we were talking before, you know, we're that flavor, but wow, it's kind of a curious, subtype of that flavor.
Yeah, I bet we don't compare very favorably with other planets that are in that epoch.
You know, there was no one before us that was of the post-magisterial sun flavor.
Right.
Those flavor of humans, see, you know, have never been on this planet, you know, and that flavor where all there was before is, you know, Adamic, you know, flavor, you know, those are never, you know, there's never going to be that normal flavor of human on this world, right? When we get into the post-magisterial sun man flavor on this planet, it's in the, you know, the wake of post-bestowal sun man.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And the Adamic was,
you know, it's
aborted.
kind of like Michael doing, you know, the higher levels of the ascension career before he does the lower levels.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right? Except that's by design from the get go. That's not an out of order peculiarity.
Right.
I mean, what we're talking about on our planet reminds me of maybe people who go to university and through advanced placement tests get to start out as sophomores, but having done that, they've missed something essentially freshman-like, and they can look around at all their classmates and feel it, and they'll never quite experience that true freshman phenomenon. They can sort of make it up in a little bit, but their course through things is just different than others around them because they did things a little out of order.
Yeah. So you've got all that complexity going on. And then this issue about dispensations, right? So you have these seven epochs of human life, there is, energy and personal ministry dispensed, right, to each order of human life, right? To dispense is to weigh out, right? So, the fact that it literally means weigh out even kind of reminds you have these material animal origin creatures weighing relative to the material. It's like, here's the current weight of these material creatures. This is what we dispense relative to their weight. Right? The really heavy ones are the pre-planetary prince man. They get lighter. Right as you go, by the time you get to post-teacher son man, right? We're not as materially weighty.
Where did you come up with that word dispense? I'm not seeing it there.
Dispensation. Dispense.
Oh, okay.
Dispensation.
Okay.
Right? A dispensation is a dispensing. And then the thing about the word dispensation, right, besides that kind of, the literal etymological sense, is, historically, theologically, it indicates the ordering events under divine authority.
Really?
Right? So, theologically, that word has been used. Right? And it's like, that's what we're talking about. They appear in the following order, right? Literally, right, is the old theological notion, the ordering of events under divine authority.
Okay? Yeah. Okay, good fit.
Visions of the divine sons. So, but see, all of that, okay, the flavor of man comes first, right, and then everything is attuned to that, right? It comes down from above, as it were, meeting us where we are as we are, right? And all of that attunement has to be completely changed when you go to the next dispensation.
You got to rewrite the textbooks, though, for what we've got going on down here.
Right, but see, no matter how clueless, we are of a certain flavor of human life.
We still do. Yeah. They can start with that textbook. We're post-bestowal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure, you can talk about where on the bell curve of post-bestowal man we are, but it's still the bell curve of post-bestowal son man.
Okay.
Right? And a holistic ministry to them ministers to the entire bell curve. Transcendent of the details of where you fit in on the bell curve.
Well, it's interesting that post-bestowal is, after the bestowal of a paradise son, which we've had, but think of the people that are living on the earth that perhaps don't know anything about that post-bestowal son. I guess it just doesn't make any difference. They are
still
living in
the age. Makes
absolutely
no difference, because we're talking about energy ministries.
Okay.
Spiritual truth, thought adjusters, yeah.
Oh, I'm with you. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. As we'll talk about, and as mankind goes forward, and we've kind of referred to this many times, when we talk about, like when I brought up the indispensables, did you have the early, half of progressing civilization, and then the latter half, the advancing phase, and how you're kind of more backing into it, right? In the early phase, you're kind of progressing in spite of yourself, and then subsequently, you're progressing because of yourself. more and more and more. Right? You know, so you know, as we go, as you go through this sequence, the farther you go along, the more it's going to depend upon, you know, the fulfillment of that epic is going to depend upon more and more on the conscious creative participation of the mortals involved.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Pre-planetary prince, man, like, now they can all be just completely clueless. Okay? But post-teacher son, man, you know, that has to almost be completely in the rearview mirror. Everyone needs to be totally consciously in the game. Right? Or it doesn't matter how excellent a teacher, a Trinity teacher son is.
Right.
Yeah. They're engaging, you know, each subsequent one is engaging individuals that are more and more consciously, properly, actively involved. I mean, that's why Michael as Jesus of Nazareth got basically nowhere, you know, in terms of conscious engagement.
I would generally agree with that, except it feels like there may almost be a little bit of a sort of a hump or in the middle of these, because post-Adamic man has to be consciously involved to the extent that they must receive a thought adjuster by some of their actions. The Old Testament is filled with that kind of those sorts of notions, but post the Stubble Son man doesn't have that. For a time, you know, you just get a thought adjuster if you're normal-minded.
Yeah, but, you know, so again, you've got the difference between, you know, what you're doing developmentally as an individual, you know, and how the civilization at large is developing.
Yeah, well, that's a very good point.
I mean, normally, right, in post-Adamic man, right, I mean, you don't have a bunch of humans that are, wow, I don't need help from a material son and daughter. I can just totally figure out all of science to the ultimatonic level all by myself. It's like, no,
yeah,
that never happens on any
no.
world. Right? Right. You know, everyone's being taught all that stuff. There's Ultima what? Right? Yeah, so, you know, I mean, you know, you've got a lot of, you know, dragging along people along by the nose rings. But the magisterial son normally comes to begin to, you know, leverage things, right? The fulcrum point there.
Right. Yeah, fair point.
Yeah, let's start transitioning from, you know, you being drugged forward by your nose ring, right, to you actually being an originative object here.
There weren't too many of those around during Jesus' time, but things were out of order. The post-Adamic man, that epic did not culminate in what it ought to. It was default. It was in default.
It didn't even get off the ground, basically, right?
Right.
Right. I mean, yeah, sure, tossed in a little bit of biologic uplift, just like Michael tossed in, you know, the spirit of truth and universal thought adjusters. Okay, but
right,
in terms of, you know, the normal face-to-face engagement, yeah, no.
It's no wonder we're so messed up down here.
Wouldn't have it any other way.
I mean, if Adam, you know, think about how cool Adam and Eve were, how impressive they were, that, you know, individuals that just lived for a handful of centuries like that, you know, are remembered 40,000 years later. Even without the revelation.
Right. Definitively, yeah.
Yeah. It's like there's a story about them in a book. Talk about a flash in the pan relative to, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. Yeah. Anyway, so we needed to spend some time up front just kind of getting this sorted out. Right? You have these dispensations, you know, you're weighing things out, you're dispensing. Okay, but see, you're dispensing two, right? First, you're dis- There's a dispensation to primitive men. And then there's a dispensation to not so primitive men, et cetera. Right? You know, in every world, you know, it's a little bit different, right? But you know, as they just said there, nonetheless, you have you know, a basic pattern.
Follow it.
All right.
Yeah.
I suppose the only other little thing, just if there might, just you know, it's totally a technical issue, nothing to do with the philosophy right up front. But for those of you looking at, you know, that might be looking at different versions of the Urantia book, there's a curious history ever since the first printing to today of all the places in the book, right, in sort of, you know, basic fashion, the word post-bestowal, you know, is one word, right? Because you know, bestowal son is not a proper designation like magisterial son. It's just a description of, you know, there's a bestowal of a son. And so B, you know, the B is not capitalized. You know, and so you don't put post, you know, hyphen because the, you know, the B is capitalized like you do with post-magisterial, post-Adamic. But in terms of the word in this list, post-bestowal son, and the words in the two section titles in this paper, it's been all over the map, whether or not they are hyphenated, kind of to be in parallel with these others or not. But, I mean, every time outside of those three kind of title locations for the word post-bestowal, I mean, all the other places in the book, including in this paper, right, post-bestowal doesn't have a hyphen in it. Yeah, because that's, yeah, you know, just not necessary.
Hmm.
Right. So, yeah. You know, yeah. Just for point of reference, for if people, you know, kind of, you know, notice that, you know, maybe you're looking at a version that, you know, doesn't have a hyphen in it, you know, and that caught your eye because all the others have a hyphen in them. Yeah, that's a kind of a curious issue where editor, you know, typesetters are going, well, I think I should.
Chris just dropped there. Is everyone else still here?
I'm still here.
Chris did drop. I'm here.
Call him back.
Why don't we? Why don't we?
There, he's back.
Reading and, okay.
Hello, this is Katie.
Oh, hi, Katie.
Oh.
Can you hear
us? No, that was a voicemail.
Answering machine.
Okay. Should we keep reading and then when he gets back, he can pick up?
Yeah, Andrea, why don't you read the next paragraph, and I'll be trying to get him back here.
Okay, here we go. The worlds of space, as soon as they are physically suitable for life, are placed on the registry of the life carriers, and in due time, these sons are dispatched to such planets for the purpose of initiating life. The entire period from life initiation to the appearance of man is designated the pre-human era, and precedes the successive mortal epochs considered in this narrative.
All
so,
right.
Yeah, they're talking about everything that happens before number one.
Right.
Here I am again.
Okay, great. Well, I already explained this paragraph to everybody, Chris, so we can just move on.
So was I the only one that got hung up on there? I don't know what happened.
Only one. That's a new one for us there.
Yeah, it was just,
you're back.
I sort of finished my sentence, and then I hear click. It's like, what?
whoops.
Was it that bad?
controversial, but not bad.
Apparently, yeah. I mean, just, boy, the overseers of this dispensation apparently had issues there. Okay.
Universal sensor.
Yeah, right, exactly.
All right, so yeah, we just read that ninth item here, that next paragraph, Chris.
Oh, okay. All right, so so notice that they, you know, reminded you a little bit there in that closing paragraph of the preface that prior to the planetary prince coming, especially in a normal world situation, the, you know, the capital S sons, the descending suns that are overseeing the world are the life carriers.
Yeah, yeah, very different suns.
You know, so that that primitive man era that we're about to read about in section one is normally being overseen by the life carriers. In our case, because the life carriers on this experimental world set up a pre-Sangic race that was going to be around for a long time before you got to the planetary prince, you had a special circumstance where there's 12 Melchizedeks that came to assist the life carriers in our pre-planetary prince man stage. They're called the Melchizedek Observers. So we, you know, for, you know, almost immediately there, once we had, actually had humans, it wasn't just the life carriers, but also these 12 Melchizedek assistants, the Melchizedek Observers, overseeing things. And, together they're, you know, they're going to be involved in, okay, it's time for a planetary prince to come. And then, of course, as I mentioned there in the last sentence, then, of course, there's the whole pre-human era, too. And just noticed that they didn't call it the animal era. They called it the pre-human era. Right? In fact, it's the animal era, but in truth, it's the pre-human era.
Right, right. There's a purpose, yeah.
Exactly. There's purposing there. I mean, the only reason there was ever single-celled plants and then single-celled animals and whatnot on this planet is because the whole point is to produce humans. That's the only reason that life is ever initiated, is to produce will creatures. So, you know, either temporally or sort of logically, the animals are the scaffolding for the human fact.
Right.
That's interesting. The way you phrased that. Of course, intellectually, I should have been able to know that life carriers are in charge of that very first planetary mortal epoch here with a little assistance, but. When I just thought it through, like my first reaction was, "Oh my gosh, they must feel like they're so in over their heads. They're just like molecular designers. They don't know how to oversee primitive humans." But then I remembered, and I can't find it at the moment, how thrilled they were, and they write about this. You know, the day that human will arrived. It's like this is what we've been waiting for. We are now ready to oversee this first type of human that has arrived. They were ecstatic that it had finally happened after 550. Million or whatever years.
Yes,
so they're
exactly.
They're trained and they're ready for it.
Yeah. Not to mention going all the way back, you know, when they first arrived and, you know, were involved in bestowing the first phase of life animation, you know, the living vitality on those prokaryotes that the power beings built.
That's a billion years ago. Yeah, they're ready. They've been waiting.
Yeah. Right. So, yeah, they're very excited when, as you remember, when you finally get to pre-planetary prince man.
Okay, number one, primitive man. From the time of man's emergence from the animal level, when he can choose to worship the Creator, to the arrival of the planetary prince, mortal will creatures are called primitive men. There are six basic types or races of primitive men, and these early peoples successively appear in the order of the spectrum colors, beginning with the red. The length of time consumed in this early life evolution varies greatly on the different worlds, ranging from 150,000 years to over 1 million years of Urantia time.
Yeah, okay, so that's, just when you have Sangics, you know, not to mention our pre-Sangic race here, the Andonites, but just in the normal world, you know, this is a pretty long, drawn-out process, you know, and as they point out in other places in the book, as they said there, you know, beginning with the red. So you have, you have, in fact, animals, right? But they're, but the Adjutant Mind Ministry, you know, in its initial phase, in its first phase, is nurturing these creatures upward until, you know, one of those strains, one of those very near pre-human strains actually crosses the threshold, right? And so you have red pre-humans, you know, and a pair of them become two, you know, a male and a female red human. And then, you know, and then there's, you know, other, all these other pre-human strains, and eventually, sometime down the road, you know, there's these orange pre-humans, and getting closer and closer to humans, and then suddenly there's a male and a female orange human, right, that rises up out of that other pre-human stock, et cetera, et cetera. You know, possibly over a very long span of time, as they're saying there, till you finally have all six sangic races. You know, if it's a world that has all six, some worlds only have the red and the yellow and the blue, the primaries.
Right.
But obviously, if the world has all six, you know, and there's some sort of complications, it could take over a million years for that process to finally, there's some indigo prehumans, right? And, you know, and slowly but surely, suddenly, there's the first pair of indigo humans.
Do you think that, you know, it says here that they appear in the order of the spectrum colors, beginning with the red, and we know on this world it all came from one family. Do you think that the red child was the firstborn?
Right. It makes you very suspicious that the order might have been, you know, been in play there. Right?
Yeah.
But in this case, you know, you see, you know, you can kind of understand what the midway or what the life carriers did, you know, in modifying the life plasm. You know, they made it so that you get all six in a quote unquote pre-blended state, you know, coming to, you know, up out of the pre-human stock. You know, so basically you got all six colors all at the same time, but, you know, melted together, as it were. All right, and so then it's just a matter of time. Eventually, right, the influence will separate those six apart. Right? In our case, in one family, you got, you know, then finally got the sangics birthed out of that andonic stock. Yep.
You're breaking up a little bit, Chris.
Am I?
No, you're sounding okay to me. It's just a little bit here or there.
Yep.
Maybe it's me.
Yeah. You're sounding a little broken up to me, Andrea. So maybe you're chopping a little bit. But again, the key here, you know, this is not the place to get into all the details of the sangic races.
Right.
I mean, for instance, you know, in paper 51, just before this, you know, they talked about the sangic racism, but the key here is, see, you know, you're calling those pre-planetary prince man primitive man, okay? And this isn't just some arbitrary designation, right? You know, like we were just trying to emphasize. It's like, well, just because they're before the planetary prince, you're gonna, you look down on them and call them primitive? It's like, no, that's their nature, right? Right? I mean, it doesn't matter, you know, if you don't have Andonites, right? It doesn't matter if, you know, you've got all six sangics, you know, come out in fairly quick succession, you know, and then the planetary prince comes and ministered all six of them right away. All those sangics before the planetary prince arrives are all primitive. Right? Their nature is changed when a new initiation is launched, or a new dispensation is launched. A new dispensation is initiated. See, I blurred the two together in my head there. That's the key, right? It's just, it's not, you're not calling them primitive because, you know, they haven't been civilized yet. Right? I mean, it's literally, that's just their nature. They haven't been upgraded yet.
Sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, and in a couple of paragraphs, we will read, lest you, you know, harbor this idea, they refer to them as splendid, even heroic.
Yeah.
There's something very special about even this first phase of man. They're primitive, but they're not humans.
I mean, right. There'll never be humans as pregnant with potential as those primitive ones. That's what's so thrilling about them. It's
then
like,
why
oh,
is it that they only just, get? Why don't they? I read on Forward here earlier, and it was said they only become spirit fused.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a second here when we actually
okay.
Yeah, read that. But see, the point of what Brad was bringing up about what we're going to read is just, you know, how, you know, it's just like, you know, what you're saying, Brad, about the life carriers, you know, when Andon and Fonta appeared. It's like, oh, this is so exciting. I mean, just the infinite potential that's now before us.
Yeah.
How thrilling, right?
Yeah.
You know, and it's sort of all downhill from here. I mean, all you're going to be doing from now on is just actualizing potential.
Yeah.
But the potential's all there. See? That's what's so thrilling about your conception when you were just a single-celled animal. Yeah, your actuality is like next to nothing. But your potentiality is infinite. Right? That's what's so thrilling about that conception. Everything lies before it now. That, you know, it's the, you know, so they're, you know, they throw in that lest you get so, you know, bogged down in the limited facts of time that you judge them by their actuality. You shouldn't judge anyone, including primitive man, by their actuality. You should judge us by our potentiality, because that's the meaning of life and the value of life. Is the potentiality.
Right.
Not the actuality.
Okay. Well, Kermit, do you want to take over for me right there?
I can certainly do that. Thank you, Andrea. I'll be happy to. The evolutionary races of color, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, and indigo, begin to appear about the time that primitive man is developing a simple language and is beginning to exercise the creative imagination. By this time, man is well accustomed to standing erect.
And so, you know, you might recall when you know, they go through the details of the precursors to Andon and Fonta here, and they're just telling you here, I mean, it's true in all cases. I mean, the pre-human stock gets to full erect status, you know, well before, you know, you get to the first humans.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and then, you know, you don't get, until you get the encirclement of the Holy Spirit, right, so that there is an upper domain, right? Before that, is in our hourglass analogy, we just have animals with lower domains, as it were, you know, and you really don't even have that, right, because you don't have the coordination that makes levels of meaning yet, okay? But crudely, right, you only have lower domains, right? If you get first two humans, they're encircled in the Holy Spirit, you've got an upper domain, right? And from the cosmos down into that domain comes language.
Language, yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And creators, you know, give you creativity down into that upper domain, you know? And that uplifts, you know, your inventive imagination down in the lower domain. You know, before that, it was just animal nature, inventive. The chimpanzee figures out, maybe I could use this, you know, grass stalk, you know, as a tool.
Right. Get the termites. Right. Right.
They don't have creativity, right? But they can be clever, right? You know, and still now, right? You know, we're still inventive. We're still clever in our lower domains, but we have the potential. Try to record if you access it to upgrade, right? Our cleverness, predicated on the creativity in the upper domain.
Okay.
Right, so he's beginning to exercise a creative imagination. That inclination that's creator-like, creative. See?
Mm-hmm. Earmark of personality, yeah.
Yeah, right. Of a encirclement Holy Spirit and a personality identifying to that, yes, exactly.
Yeah, until you're doing that, you're just doing fancier and fancier versions of collecting birds' nests for making fire, I guess.
You know, and animals can, you know, can imitate language. They can't originate it because they don't have an originative domain. They don't have an upper domain.
Yeah, some of the higher avians, parrots, extinct birds, yeah, they can imitate our language, but they don't originate it. Good point.
Right. Yep.
Primitive men are mighty hunters and fierce fighters. The law of this age is the physical survival of the fittest. The government of these times is wholly tribal. During the early racial struggles on many worlds, some of the evolutionary races are obliterated, as occurred on Urantia. Those who survive are usually subsequently blended with the later imported violet race, the Adamic peoples.
And we lost most of our orange and green, as they're indicating there. You know, notice it's wholly tribal, right? Because, I mean, it, everything is completely natural here, basically, still. Right? So, you know, it's when you go from tribe to nation that, you know, you're going to need some assistance because that's an unnatural thing to begin to go above beyond tribe. You know, and if you're using the terms folkways and mores, you know, where mores is a distinction, an advanced state relative to merely folkways. See, all you have is folkways. All you just have what comes naturally, right? From the clans and the subsequent tribes, right? But when they start to bring some unnaturalness, some more top-down reflection into that, you know, sort of the common welfare, well, they should maybe call them mores then, right? You know, the descending sons are going to facilitate going from folkways to mores, going from tribe to nation.
Where does the term horde fit into this tribal so-called government?
It all starts with the horde, you know, then you get families, and then you get clans, and then you get tribes.
Okay, so hordes are pre-tribal, basically, is what you're saying.
Pre-family.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Pre-family, yeah.
Pre-everything, yeah. You know, and, of course, even though there may be some groups that are tribal, you're going to have some that are still clear back in horde.
Yeah.
Right. Even now on this planet, there's some peoples that are, you know, barely clan-like.
Yeah.
Let alone tribal.
In the light of subsequent civilization, this era of primitive man is a long, dark, and bloody chapter. The ethics of the jungle and the morals of the primeval forests are not in keeping with the standards of later dispensations of revealed religion and higher spiritual development. On normal and non-experimental worlds, this epoch is very different from the prolonged and extraordinary brutal struggles which characterized this age on Urantia. When you have emerged from...
Uh-oh.
Oh. Now we lost Kermit. Yeah.
Now we lost Kermit.
All right.
Here.
You want to read some, Brad?
Yeah.
I
will. When you have emerged from your first world experience, you will begin to see why this long and painful struggle on the evolutionary worlds occurs. And as you go forward in the paradise path, you will increasingly understand the wisdom of these apparently strange doings.
But notwithstanding all the vicissitudes of the early ages of human emergence, the performances of primitive man represent a splendid, even a heroic chapter in the annals of an evolutionary world of time and space.
Yeah, so there it is, your reference. You notice that they're reminding us of again, you know, it's quite a prolonged, you know, state here because of the pre-Sangic races. You've got all the survival of the fittest stuff, very bloody and whatnot. Notice that statement kind of in the middle. When you have emerged from your first world experience, you'll begin to see why this long and painful struggle in the evolutionary worlds occurs.
Mm-hmm.
That's related to, what we were talking about before. Once you finally get on high, you know, and don't have such illusions and delusions about your nature being, oh, I think I'm ready for the Isle of Paradise. When you more directly understand, you know, just, you know, what it takes to actually be part of eternity, you'll understand that, when you start incredibly primitive like this, I mean, you know, you are so far removed from something that is fit. Right?
Fit, right.
That has
right.
some measure of cosmic wholeness to it, and hence could be, you know, oriented towards eternity. That's what they're getting at. You know, it's like, wow, I had such delusions. I thought, you know, the magic man could just take any blob of protoplasm and turn it into a finaliter. It's like, no. I mean, there, you know, this has to be a distillation out of the ocean that is sort of pregnant with that potential to begin with.
Right.
Otherwise, it's inexorably going to be culled from the herd.
Well, and welcome back, Kermit. that sentence there, it's presaged by some of our own experiences here. What, you know, thoughtful parent hasn't reflected back and said the same thing, like, to my children, when you have emerged from your first adolescence, you will begin to see, ..
Yeah.
How many of us grew up hearing, someday you'll understand, you know?
Yes.
And we should already understand this is the pattern of the cosmos.
Yeah. And, you know, and when they're saying ethics and morals, you know, that second sentence, okay, you know, we've got some serious quotes on those, okay? I mean, quote-unquote ethics of the jungle and the quote-unquote morals of the primeval forest, right? I mean, they're just pointing out, you're in circuit in the Holy Spirit, so, you know, you have this notion of morality begins to trickle down into your consciousness. Right, and the only quote-unquote cosmic context you have is the primeval forest to have some sort of big picture, right, for morality, right, to subject yourself to, you know. And then what about, you know, between individuals, the ethics, quote-unquote? Well, it's the ethics of the jungle, right? in the same way we metaphorically use that word jungle like that. All right.
All right. Kermit, are you back with us now? I saw him back on the switchboard.
Oh.
Okay. Well, I can keep us going here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Early evolutionary man is not a colorful creature. In general, these primitive mortals are cave dwellers or cliff residents. They also build crude huts in the large trees. Before they acquire a high order of intelligence, the planets are sometimes overrun with the larger types of animals. But early in this era, mortals learn to kindle and maintain fire. And with the increase of inventive imagination and the improvement in tools, evolving man soon vanquishes the larger and more unwieldy animals.
The early races also make extensive use of the larger flying animals. These enormous birds are able to carry one or two average-sized men for a nonstop flight of over 500 miles. On some planets, these birds are of great service since they possess a high order of intelligence, often being able to speak many words of the languages of the realm. These birds are most intelligent, very obedient, and unbelievably affectionate. Such passenger birds have been long extinct on Urantia, but your early ancestors enjoyed their services.
And it was
I wonder if they'll have them on the Mansion World.
You can look that up. The Prince's staff trained our passenger birds, so they were first being used as passenger birds subsequent to the Prince's arrival, but as I mentioned there, they became extinct over 30,000 years ago. You can imagine, you have Adam and Eve defaulting and dying, and these are probably going to slip through the cracks.
I guess so. Yeah. All we have left are the crows and the ravens. Oh, well.
If Adam and Eve hadn't defaulted and we're still here, right? We could still walk up and pet a passenger bird. So there's that issue there. But then the other, of course, is that you always I have large, unwieldy animals that need to be vanquished. Right?
Like dinosaurs?
One of the mammals. The first humans on every world need to get rid of the large blobs of protoplasm that want to crush their huts.
Which by coincidence means they have to band together and start undertaking some common causes beyond themselves.
Yes. Yep. Right. So that's always part of the process of wiping out all of those creatures. It's like, okay, there's no place for these. The whole point of this world is the humans, right? And so you can't have some gigantic mammal stomping through everything.
Funny to think about, but okay.
Yeah.
All right. Let's see. Man's acquirement of ethical judgment, moral will, is usually coincident with the appearance of early language. Upon attaining the human level, after this emergence of mortal will, these beings become receptive to the temporary indwelling of the divine adjusters. And upon death, many are duly elected as survivors and sealed by the archangels for subsequent resurrection and spirit fusion. The archangels always accompany the planetary princes, and a dispensational adjudication of the realm is simultaneous with the prince's arrival.
So this, item number one here, primitive man, is a dispensation. Even though we're pre-planetary prince, it's still a dispensation. And it's very appropriate to your question about spirit fusion. As I was saying, you have humans in a certain physical, mindful, spiritual energy system, right, which, except for exceptions, like in our case, Anda and Infanta and some of their children, right, were father fusers. But subsequently, and even see among some of their children, they're not of a nature that an adjuster can fuse with. You need something that's downstepped, like the spirit fragment from the local universe mother spirit, to fuse with that individual. Again, it's just stressing, the literalness of the different order of creature. The exact physics is mysterious to even the revelators, right? But
right.
The basic understanding is, you're reminding yourself that they are in fact different, so different, like a non-breather is, so different that they're only spirit fusers.
Just a very different type
strange.
Of human. Yeah.
There's not enough like to like, for father fusion.
All right.
Yep.
All mortals who are indwelt by thought adjusters are potential worshippers. They have been lighted by the true light and they possess capacity for seeking reciprocal contact with divinity. Nevertheless, the early or biologic religion of primitive man is largely a persistence of animal fear, coupled with ignorant awe and tribal superstition. The survival of superstition in the Urantia races is hardly complementary to your evolutionary development, nor compatible with your otherwise splendid achievements in material progress. But this early fear religion serves a very valuable purpose in subduing the fiery tempers of these primitive creatures. It is the forerunner of civilization and the soil for the subsequent planting of the seeds of revealed religion by the planetary prince and his ministers.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Maybe the reason that we still have fear religion is not because we're continuing to have primitive religion. Maybe it's because we're primitive, as they point out in one place in the book.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and again, remember by this, you know, this very interesting title of fear religion, right? That's, if you go to the beginning of the evolution of religion, paper 85, The Origins of Worship, it says, man creates his primitive religions out of his fears and by means of his illusions.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and on the one hand, you can call it primitive religion, but on the other hand, you can call it religion for primitives. You know, if we're basically fear-based still, in that sense, we're pre-planetary prince man. That's why Jesus said, fear not. It's like, why don't you give not being a primitive man a try?
Yeah. Although it's not literally true in the sense of these epics. We will never once again have primitive men here, but we can certainly act like them. We can emulate them.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Right. You're not technically primitive man, but effectively you are.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. You're dominated by animal fear.
Hmm. Interesting.
Within 100,000 years from the time man acquires erect posture, the planetary prince usually arrives, having been dispatched by the system's sovereign upon the report of the life carriers that will is functioning. Even though comparatively few individuals have thus developed, primitive mortals usually welcome the planetary prince and his visible staff. In fact, they often look upon them with awe and reverence, almost with worshipfulness if they are not restrained.
Yep, so there, you know, you can see the second level of meaning with awe and reverence, you know, coming into play there. You know, up from anguish and dread on the first
mm-hmm.
level. You know, and notice that when, you know, when those prehumans do achieve erect posture, okay, everyone knows, okay, it's not too long until we've got will creatures.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, saying that the planetary prince usually arrives, you know, kind of, you know, based upon that benchmark, right? But not to confuse, just because it's, you know, erect doesn't mean it's a human yet.
Right. Still takes a while, but it's on its way. Yeah.
They made it sound like the humans on the planet knew that this the planetary prince was coming.
They welcome
him. Did I read that wrong, you know?
Well, yeah, we're almost out of time. I was thinking that, you know, there are some, you know, there's some adjuster leadings that happen, you know, in the, getting the people, the first, the hundred, the prince's staff to get to the right place at the right time. So maybe there's something to do
mm-hmm.
with that.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a whole kind of a coordination thing so that there's kind of, you know, a welcoming of the secondary, you know, staff, if nothing else.
Yeah.
Right.
Would make for an amazing dramatization in a movie, but that script has yet to be written. All right. We're out of time for this week, and Kermit did want to let you all know that he was able to call back in but couldn't be heard. But I'm sure he would say God bless everyone, as is his tradition here. But he is listening to us, so I'll say God bless everyone and follow the way. The arc's off to a fine start. Tune back in next week.
Night, everyone.
Yep, take care, everyone. Apologize for our technical issues tonight. That's a mystery. We'll have to see if we can figure out, and we probably can't. But tune in next week, and we're going to take a look at the developmental epics of progressive civilization in parallel to this before we continue on and talk about post-planetary Prince Man. So until then, take care, everyone.